Genesis 37, verse 1 to 8. Joseph's dream. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers, while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a multicolored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved them more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now I'm going to read the scripture in Spanish. José es vendido por sus hermanos. Habitó Jacob en la tierra donde había morado su padre, en la tierra de Canaán. Esta es la historia de la familia de Jacob. José, siendo de edad de 17 años, apacentaba las ovejas con sus hermanos. Y el joven estaba con los hijos de Bilhah y con los hijos de Zilpah, mujeres de su padre. E informaba a José a su padre la mala fama de ellos. Y amaba José, Israel a José, más que a todos sus hijos, porque lo había tenido en su vejez. Y le hizo una túnica de diversos colores. Y viendo sus hermanos que su padre lo amaba más que a todos sus hermanos, le aborrecían y no podían hablarle pacíficamente. Y soñó José un sueño y lo contó a sus hermanos, y ellos llegaron a aborrecerle más todavía. Y él les dijo, "Oíd ahora este sueño que he soñado. He aquí que atábamos manojos en medio del campo, y he aquí que mi manojo se levantaba y estaba derecho, y que vuestros manojos estaban alrededor y se inclinaban al mío." Le respondieron sus hermanos, "¿Reinarás tú sobre nosotros o señorearás sobre nosotros?" Y le aborrecieron aún más a causa de sus sueños y sus palabras.
So for the next 13 chapters, we look at the life of Joseph. And it's a life of suffering. It's a road of suffering that leads to glory. That's how the road to glory works in the Bible. It's always through suffering. And Joseph, he suffers a lot. If anything, the next 13 chapters are at least a study in suffering. Joseph, he has people lying about him. He has people sinning against him. This morning, his brothers conspire to kill him. He lives a life of suffering. Maybe some of you can resonate with that. You've experienced a life of suffering as well, or at least to some degree. I had lunch with a friend this past week. His name is Joseph too, and he's lived a life of suffering. It's a life of suffering I haven't had to live. He grew up in a house where his dad abused him for 9 years, and he confronted him on that when he was 19, and also forgave him, by the way, forgave him and confronted him. And his dad just disappeared for 2 years after that and didn't really say much, didn't reach out at all until he gets a call from him one day, 2 years later, and says, "You know, hey, come over. I want you to come over and see me." And so my friend Joseph, he goes and he goes to see his dad, and on the door is a suicide note. And he walks in and it's his dad's body. That's the next time that he saw his dad. And he's lived a lifetime of this. He's got chronic illness that he suffered greatly from. Him and his wife have suffered from infertility. He's had near-death experiences. It's just been a life of suffering. And it's not just been suffering, you know, that's just happened. It's been a sin too. Just recently, deep under the surface sin just kind of brought up, you know, in force and destruction all across his world right now. Just everything about this dark sin that just kind of came up out, and now he's having to deal with that. I mean, it's just suffering after suffering after suffering. Some of you, you've had lives like that. All of us, to some degree, have suffered. And if we aren't suffering, we're going to, right? That's just, it's coming for us if it's not there right now. That's just a reality. It's a broken, sinful world. We're not playing, you know, this isn't, you know, candy cane Christianity at this church, right? It's not, you know, have enough faith and everything's gonna be awesome. No, it might not be awesome. So you're either in suffering or it's coming for us. That's what we know to be true. And Joseph, he experienced this life of suffering. Now, evil and suffering is often used as evidence that either God's not good, or he's not powerful, or he doesn't even exist, right? Have you heard those? Well, how can there be evil and suffering in the world and God be good? How can there be evil and suffering in the world and God be powerful? How could there be evil and suffering in the world and God exists? We've heard those arguments. Richard Dawkins, the atheist, he says, or at least communicates what many of us have heard or maybe even felt. He says, the total amount of suffering per year in the world is beyond all decent contemplation. Isn't that true? In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt and other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. We've heard those arguments before, right? If there's evil, if there's suffering, then there's no God. There's no God. Now, the Christian, rather, the atheist, is not the only one that gets to question suffering and even question God in the midst of suffering. Now, the atheist doesn't get to do it. They haven't cornered the market on questioning God. The Bible tells us that we should bring our doubts to God and ask God where he is in the midst of things. Did you know that? And so I'm just going to keep doing this all throughout the life of this church, but even the rest of Genesis. I want to keep introducing you to the Psalms because we have to learn how to lament before God. We have to. We've got to learn like this stigma that you can't doubt in the church. That needs to be gone. And we need to be able to take our doubts and our sufferings and our questions and bring them to God, because what we keep seeing is that in your suffering, you distance yourself from God. No, and you do that because you think that faith means you never struggle, or faith means you never doubt, or faith means you're not ever asking God why. No. Faith means you go to God with those questions. That's what faith means. And so I'm going to keep introducing you to the Psalms. That was kind of a mini sermon. I'm sorry. I'm going to read a psalm. Here's a psalm, okay? Psalm of suffering, because the atheist doesn't have the market cornered on asking God questions about suffering or wondering if he is there. Psalm 44:23, it says, "Awake, why are you sleeping, O Lord?" Have you ever prayed like that? "Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and our oppression?" We've all thought that way. Have you prayed it? The classic psalm of suffering, David in Psalm 13, the first two verses say, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me?" The Bible is commanding you to cry out to God in your suffering, to question, to ask the questions, to wonder where he is in the midst of it. And we can do that. It can do that. The Bible and God can call us to that because of the theme verse of the rest of Genesis. The rest of Genesis all leads up to this culminating verse where Joseph, at the end of the book, says to his brothers, "Hey, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. That what you meant for evil, God meant for good." That behind all of the suffering, right, beyond all of the pain and the sorrow and the tears, and all of that, is a God who rescues, is a God who restores, is a God who's working out good through the evil and the suffering. So he can say, "Yeah, come to me with this. Come, you can ask me questions. You can draw near to me. I know sometimes it doesn't feel like I'm there. So come and cry out to me. Come and cry out to me." And so here we're going to talk about suffering. And we're going to talk about suffering. We're going to talk about suffering in the next 13 weeks, especially today. And here's all that I've wanted and all that I've hoped for us, that there'd just be this one thing that you grab a hold of, the one thing that you just kind of hear and see about God and about suffering this morning. That's all, just one thing, okay? And I've been praying that the Holy Spirit, when you hear it, when you see it, he would take it and he would stamp it to your soul. It would bring about healing. Because if you don't need that healing now, you will, okay? So it's coming. And so if we just have the Holy Spirit just glue this thing to our soul, that we would know, that we would just be healed, we would be comforted by just this one thing, and we'll get to it. So turn to Genesis 37. Genesis 37. We'll be introduced here to Joseph. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy, it means apprentice or assistant, with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. So we're introduced here to Joseph. Joseph is a young man. He's 17 years old. He's in the family business, right? So he's an assistant. He's an apprentice shepherd. He's working for his older brothers. And it says that he brought a bad report to his dad. So bad report here, it pretty much means false report. Like he's exaggerating something. He's telling on. He's a tattletale. That's what it's saying, right? Joseph is this young, kind of arrogant tattletale telling on his brothers. That's how we're introduced to him. Okay, so just like real quick, I don't know if this is biblical. I think it's biblical, but we teach our kids not to tattle. But here's what we say: we teach them Matthew 18. Let me show you Matthew 18, honey. We don't tell on our sister because you're supposed to take to your sister their sin, their disobedience, and then if they repent, you've gained your sister, honey. And if she doesn't repent, you can come to daddy, and daddy will take care of this thing. Okay, we'll do some church discipline in the home with sissy if she doesn't repent. But first, go to her. Don't come to daddy and tattletale. Joseph doesn't do that. He's just coming to his dad. He's the favorite. He's coming to his dad and telling on his older brothers. That's what we first see. And we see that he's dad's favorite, that Jacob, he's showing favoritism to one of his kids. Never a good idea. We've already learned that in Genesis, right? Just not a good idea. So Jacob, he was a mama's boy. His dad didn't love him the most. His dad loved Esau the most. And so he's this mama's boy with this great big father wound. And so what he does is he just takes all of that's missing in his heart, and he doesn't go to the Lord. He takes that to Rachel, right? And he just loves Rachel. Rachel's his favorite wife. Rachel's the wife he really loves. And his whole identity is in Rachel, but then she dies. And so she dies, and so then he has to move that now to her son, Joseph. And so now Joseph is his all. It's this, you know, my identity is in my son kind of thing. He's my favorite. Just as a quick aside, if there is any of that in you, moms and dads, we've got to kill this, right? It's just destructive. We've seen it all throughout Genesis. This idea of favoring one kid over the other is unbelievably destructive. And so if there's just any of that in you, just maybe you experienced that in your family. Maybe you were like Jacob and your brother or your sister was the favorite. And so now you're kind of putting this undue pressure on one kid over another to be awesome for you or something. If that's in you, would you just bring that to light, confess that? Let's get rid of that now before that becomes too big of a deal. Because this stuff has been really destructive. But Joseph, he's his favorite. And so he gets this coat, right? This famous coat of many colors from his dad. Now there's some debate over like, was it really a lot of colors? And it doesn't matter. What this means is that it's a royal garb. It's a royal coat. It's this lavish, expensive sign, present that you're my favorite. It was a constant reminder to all of his brothers that he was better than them, that he was more loved than them. It was a constant reminder. It could even mean that he's going to be the heir, that he's going to gain all of the influence and most of the wealth, and he was going to be like the firstborn son. He was going to get the inheritance from his dad, but at the least, it's this daily reminder, I'm more loved than you. I'm more loved than you. And so then naturally, not godly, but naturally, they hate him. They hate him, right? The brothers, they can't even speak peacefully with him. It means they couldn't even greet him. They couldn't even say shalom to him. You ever been in that relationship where there's just so much bitterness that you can't even fake it anymore? You can't even pretend to like the other person, or they can't pretend to like you. You can barely even say hello. And so the best thing is just to ignore one another. That's where they're at. It's a very, very broken, broken place, as his brothers just hate Joseph because he's the favored son. Let's see what happens next. Look at verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us?" And so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers. Not good. "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars are bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now we're going to learn that these dreams are actually from the Lord, that these are prophetic dreams that God actually is going to bring to pass. Dreams in the Bible aren't normal, but they are in here, right? And so this dream actually is from the Lord. But the picture here that we're meant to see is that Joseph is this young, brash, arrogant, tattletale kind of punk who is getting these dreams from God, and then at the least foolishly telling that to his brothers, if not arrogantly trying to rub it in their faces. "Here's what's going to happen to me." That's what's going on here, right? Twice he's like, "Hey guys, by the way, you're going to bow down to me." And that's not good. You shouldn't do that, right? So that's what's going on here. He's arrogant. He's doing this thing in front of his brothers, telling them what's going on. And Joseph, throughout the rest of Genesis, is portrayed as a very righteous, suffering servant king. He's a picture of Jesus. He's kind of like Noah in that respect, but he's also a sinner, right? He's also human. Here he's a 17, a little immature, a little arrogant, and he's boasting to his brothers. And it says in verse 11 that they were jealous of him. Yeah, we can understand that, right? They were jealous of him. Now Proverbs says that jealousy, it's rottenness to your bones, jealousy is. That it's like a cancer that just eats away at you from the inside. It means that far before jealousy actually hurts somebody else, it hurts you. That's just eating away at you, and it's harming you and hurting you, and that's what the brothers have. They've got this jealousy in them. And so everyone in this family is depicted as just broken and sinful. It just hasn't really been much shift from all of Genesis till now, that Joseph is a sinner and Jacob is a sinner and his brothers are sinners. Now, these sins are real under the surface kind of subversive sins. Do you notice that? Right? It's jealousy, it's arrogance, it's foolishness, it's favoritism. A lot of this stuff is just kind of under the surface. And it's those under the surface subversive sins that are maybe the most dangerous. We just manage them. We don't kill them. We just kind of pretend like they're not that big of a deal because they're not that big of a deal yet. Right? There's those sins that are just kind of in the dark corners of our heart that we don't do much with. We don't really mess with. We just kind of leave them there because they haven't done anything too bad yet. They haven't hurt anybody yet. It's those sins that we should be most afraid of. We should be most careful to actually do the work of, "God, I got to bring this to light. We got to deal with this. We got to kill this thing. I can't manage this sin." But they do. But they do, and they are. It's those sins we got to be really careful of. What we mean for evil, God means for good. Well, sometimes what we mean for evil starts off as just a little bitty sin, no big deal. No big deal. Just kind of subvert under the surface, hasn't hurt anybody yet. Just this little bitty sin, no big deal. That's where it starts. And so let's keep going. Look at verse 12. Let's see what happens here. This is a great story. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? come, I will send you to them. So he's at home with his dad, not working like his brothers are. Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, what are you seeking? I'm seeking my brothers, he said. Tell me, please, where are they pasturing the flock? And the man said, they have gone away, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him, throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. But when Reuben heard of it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, let us not take his life. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. As the oldest, Reuben would be most responsible for Joseph. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum and balm and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by. They drew Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. It's amazing, isn't it? The conflict that happens so quickly and what's going on and all of it. It's amazing. It's an amazing story. This subversive, under the surface sin escalates quickly to conspiracy to commit murder and slavery. It's a big deal. So two things I want to talk about here. First thing is this, the suffering of Joseph. The suffering. Did you see all the various ways in which Joseph suffered as we read? Firstly, in verse 17, it says that Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Dothan was this place where the great Old Testament prophet Elisha, where Elisha was with his servant, and there's this army that was out coming after them, right? So this army is coming after them. They're in Dothan, and Elisha, it's this great, like, epic story of the Bible. If you haven't heard it, it's awesome. He says to his servant, he says, don't be afraid, for there are more with us than are with them. And the servant's like, no, there's not. no, there's not. There's an army. And then it says, the Lord opened the eyes of the servant, and he saw the mountain full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha, right? It's just this heavenly army, this angels with swords that they're gonna protect Elisha and the servant. It's awesome, right? That's the Old Testament Bible that we think about, right? That's awesome. That's a great story. So that's where Dothan is. That's what happens at Dothan. Joseph doesn't get that though. Joseph doesn't get a heavenly army vision. Joseph doesn't get assurance of God's presence. Joseph doesn't get that at all. He just is walking to this place alone by himself. And it says in verse 18 that they saw him from afar and conspired against him to kill him. They conspired against him to kill him. Has this ever happened to you? Maybe not to this degree, but people talking about you? People in a quiet room, people behind closed doors planning to hurt you, planning to disregard you, planning to ignore you, gossip, slander, talking about you behind your back. Have you ever experienced that? His brothers, his own brothers, conspiring, planning, drawing it up to kill him. Jesus, he went through this. It says in Matthew 26:4 that the chief priests and the elders, they conspired to arrest Jesus by stealth. Right? It's always under the darkness. It's always behind the door. It's always, right, in secret. And they conspire to arrest him by stealth, and then it says, and to kill him. That's what Joseph is going through here. His brothers, he's approaching, and his brothers have a plan to hurt him. And then in verse 23, he arrives, and it says they stripped him of his robe, right? In essence, stripping him of his identity and his dignity. Right? This was given to him. This was a sign of his father's love to him. And he was stripped of it in a jealous rage. Let's get rid of this coat of this dreamer. Have you ever had somebody just in anger and in jealousy cut you down? Right? Just cut you down. They attacked you, not just something you might have done or whatever. It was you that they were cutting down. It was your identity that they were attacking. It was your dignity that they were trying to rob. That's what's happening. Jesus, he was stripped naked on the cross. They rolled dice for his clothes. At one point, they put on a robe, much like Joseph's robe, this robe of many colors. It was a purple robe of royalty, but they did it to mock him. Hail, King of the Jews. They beat him. They mocked him. That's what Joseph is going through. That's what he's experienced. That's the suffering that we're talking about, his very identity being attacked. And then it says they threw him in verse 24. They threw him into a pit. It doesn't say it here, but in chapter 42, it tells us that Joseph, as we might expect, was crying out from the pit. Help me. Get me out of here. I don't know. I can imagine maybe the first time was, ha ha, brothers, you know, nice joke. Get me out now. And it says that no one listened. That he was crying out from the pit and nobody heard him. Have you ever been in that place where you were crying out and it seemed like nobody listened? That's where Joseph is. Right, where you reach out to a friend, I'm in need, and they don't help you, they ignore you, or perhaps they do respond to you, but it's not super helpful. They kind of brushed you off. Or maybe you're even crying out to the Lord, right? You're praying. But have you ever prayed and it feels like you're just talking to the walls? Joseph, he's crying out and no one hears him. Jesus on the cross, he cried out and no one heard him. He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he's quoting Psalm 22. He's quoting the Psalms, but he's saying, God, it seems like you're not here. It seems like you've turned your back on me. Where are you, God? Why have you forsaken me? Have you been in that place before? That's where Joseph is. Crying out. Nobody listening. And then in verse 28, they take him out of the pit and they sell him to these traders on the way to Egypt. His own family, his own brothers. You ever been betrayed by somebody close to you? Spouse, friend, girlfriend, boyfriend, family member, brother, sister, mom, dad. He's betrayed by those closest to you. If you've ever been betrayed by somebody close to you, there's like this shock and dismay that goes along with everything. It's not just the pain. It's not just what happened. It's this, I can't, like, you were supposed to be for me. You were supposed to protect me. You were supposed to be there for me. You're on my side, and now you're not on my side. You're my enemy. And there's this shock. There's this dismay. There's this, I can't believe. This isn't true. Is this true? I can't believe this is true. You ever been betrayed by somebody close to you? That's what Joseph is going through. He's in the pit and he's crying out and then he's dragged out and he's sold. And you can just imagine, like, what just happened? This can't be true. Have you experienced that? Jesus, he experienced that as well, right? He was betrayed by those closest to him. He was betrayed by Peter. He was betrayed by Judas. Man, he had given his life to. Man that he had shared his life with, and they betrayed him. That's what Joseph is going through. And then it says that they sold him for 20 pieces of silver. 20, he didn't just get betrayed, he got sold. Can you imagine someone putting a price on you? Has you ever had just somebody determine your worth and your value? Have you ever let somebody determine your worth and your value? Can you imagine what this is like? Can you imagine have somebody put a dollar amount on what you're worth? That's what he's going through. Like, just imagine chattel slavery 150 years ago. A human being up for sale. How much? It's going on around us, sex trafficking all around us, little girls for sale. How much for her? Can you imagine that? Can you believe that? Jesus went through this as well. He was sold for 30 pieces of silver. Judas sold them. How much for Jesus? 25? No, needs to be 30. 30. 35? No, I'm good with 30. 30 is about what he's worth to me. Can you imagine somebody determining your value and your worth? Have you experienced that kind of suffering? That's hard, man. So he's betrayed by his family. His worth is determined by somebody else. And this is just the beginning of a season of suffering for Joseph. It doesn't stop here. It doesn't stop here. There's more to come. And so I want us to look at the suffering of Joseph. But then the second thing I want us to see is the providence of God here. The unseen hand of God at work in all of this, in this whole story. And so, for instance, Joseph, he's walking. He just happens to run into a man, right? Happens to run into a man that knows where his brothers are. And that man happens to have overheard that his brothers are in Dothan. And so he heads to Dothan. And then Reuben, who keeps Joseph from getting killed, right? He's like, no, let's not kill him. Let's just throw him in the pit and I'll get him out later, he thinks to himself. Right, he's there to keep him from being killed, but then he's out of the scene. I don't know if you noticed this, out of the scene when they decide to sell him to the traders on their way to Egypt. He's not there because he would have prevented that. Right? So he just happens to be in the right place at the right time and then the wrong place at the wrong time. Happens to. And there just happens to be these traders walking along the way as Joseph's brothers are eating a sandwich and wondering what to do with their brother in the pit there. And so they sell him into slavery, not knowing, like completely unaware that what they're actually doing is carrying out what God is setting out to do. They say, let's kill this dreamer here, or let's see what happens with this man's dreams. All the while, they're fulfilling the dreams. And he goes to Egypt, he becomes a ruler, they go and bow down to their brother. All of this pointing to the providential work of God, the providence of God, the invisible hand of God. Even the doubling of Joseph's dreams at the beginning, that he had two of them, that's pointing to the providence of God. Joseph tells us in chapter 41, verse 32, when he's talking about Potiphar's, or rather Pharaoh's dreams, the king of Egypt, he's saying that the doubling of the dreams means that this is fixed by God. So even the two dreams at the beginning of the story is saying God is providentially involved in this. He is at work in this. His name is never mentioned. God never speaks. He never shows up, but he's in all of it. Here's what that means. That means that the God of the Bible, the one true God, is involved in every aspect of your life. We are not deists. We don't believe in deism where, this creator God creates and then he's gone. Like he's just done now, right? He's in some cosmic Florida, retired, playing shuffleboard with the angels. That's not what we believe. Right? Where he just, the world is like a big clock and God wound the clock and then he's gone, right? Just completely uninvolved. That's not who we are. We're not deists. We're not open theists. We don't believe in open theism where it's, God sees our suffering, but he doesn't know what to do. He can't do anything about it. He's impotent to act, and he couldn't see it coming even. He's just taken aback. I can't believe that there was suffering. Well, can you help us, God? Actually, no, I can't. I'm sorry. We're not open theists. We believe in Jesus, who creates all things and holds all things together, Colossians 1 says. That's what we believe. And so we believe that God is literally orchestrating 10,000 things in your life right now. That right now where you are and when you are there has been predetermined by the plan of God. That Acts 17 says that he determines your boundary places and your lines and the times in which you might live there, that you might pursue God and know him. That where you are and when you are there is for your joy and your pursuit of holiness, that you might know more of him. That he's orchestrating 10,000 things, the people that you're around, the obstacles you face, the opportunities that are there before you, the open doors and the closed doors, all the work that he is doing in your life and around your life that affects your life, this symphony of providence of God. And Psalm 34 says that he withholds no good thing from you, which means that right now there is nothing that he is keeping from you that is for your joy. That right now he has you in the exact place working these 10,000 things around you for exactly the purposes of doing you good. It's the providence of God. That's the providence of God. And it means that the God, he loved Joseph just as much as he loved Elisha. And God, he saves Joseph just like he saved Elisha. And God is still God in the silence, just like he's the God when he writes it on the wall or gives you a dream. He's still the God in the silence. God, he is working in you just as much in those everyday moments as he is in those real big God moments. Yep. God, he's just as good in the suffering as he is in the blessing. And here's the thing, we want the miraculous and we want the big God moment. That's just, I don't know, it's what we pursue, it's what we want, it's what we want that. We want that. But I think it's the everyday norm of experiencing the providential hand of God that is most life-giving. That's most life-giving. That's when we experience God the most in his everyday movement, everyday working, and everyday providence. I think it's most life-giving, more valuable that. So kind of like the under-the-surface subversive sin can be most damaging because we don't see it and it's there every day, it's festering, right? I think that under-the-surface subversive providential hand of God is most life-giving. Most life-giving. That God, he's not this, you know, absentee dad who, because he hasn't been around much, shows up every once in a while, tries to buy you off with expensive gifts and big things. Right? That's not our God. Our God is every day present, every day providing, every day protecting. And so he doesn't have to do that. He's not the God, you know, of the big miraculous moment. He's the everyday God too. He's the everyday God too. And we know his love much more that way. Right? We know his love much more when we see it than just when we hear it. Right? Husbands, you tell your wife you love her, but if you don't show her, it doesn't mean much, does it? But it's the everyday protection, the everyday providing, the everyday presence that then validates the I love you. Yeah, that's right. You do. I can see that. I know that. Thank you for expressing that to me. I see it. You've shown me your love, not just told me. So God, he wants to show you his love. And he shows you his love in that everyday faithfulness, the everyday providence in your life. Not those big, huge, miraculous God moments that's not what you need. You need an everyday God. Yeah, that's why we talk about sin all the time here. That's why we talk about Jesus all the time here, because you need to see how much God hates sin, and you need to see how much the Father loves the Son, because then it makes the gospel all that more crazy and amazing that God would then crush the Son to save sinners. The cross is God showing us that he loves us, not just telling us. Not just telling us. And so he wants us to see his love, see his work, see his providence. And so we see great suffering in this story of Joseph, but we also see this great providence from this everyday God. All right, well, let's keep going, see what happens next. Finish this up, verse 29. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and where shall I go?" He doesn't know what to do. He's going to be held responsible. Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in the blood, and they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether this is your son's robe or not." This is a little ironic, right? Jacob the deceiver being deceived. goat skins. That's how he deceived his dad Isaac about Esau. This is ironic a little bit. Verse 33, he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments, put sackcloth on his loins, mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol," or death, "and to my son, mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Joseph, it says in verse 35, that he could not be comforted. He refused to be comforted. Have you ever been in that place where you don't even want to be comforted? You probably don't think you could be, but you're refusing comfort. That's where he is. He's like, "Man, I just gotta sit in this. I need to feel this pain. I'm gonna take this to the grave with me. I can't. This is my everything is gone." He's experienced great loss here. Jacob, he doesn't know Genesis 50:20. He doesn't know that God is meaning good with this evil. Right? Joseph, on his way right now to Egypt in chains, still shocked at the betrayal of his brothers, is doesn't know that God is meaning good out of this, right? I don't know, maybe they have a theology like we have, maybe they have a concept of God and his working and his goodness, but they don't know Genesis 50 yet. They just know that somebody meant evil. What do we do? What do we do in the midst of suffering? What do we do in the midst of our affliction? What do we do in the midst of our oppression or our pain when we can't see what God sees? What do we do then? When you can't see what God sees, what do you do in that time? I know we're supposed to have faith. And I know we're supposed to cling to the promises of God. And I know what my theology says. I know what my books say. I know what Romans 8:28 says, that all things work for good. I know that. I know Genesis 50:20 says that he's meaning good out of this evil that's meant. I know that. But what do I do in the midst of the suffering when we don't see it? Are you tracking with that? What do we do then? Like, what do we do then? I know. I'm a 36-year-old man. I've matured some, and I have more to go. And I know that as I experience the grace of God and the goodness of God and the providence of God, and as I suffer with God, and more that I mature, the more and more that I understand, my theology just becomes part of my life, and it hardens into this solid rock ground that when suffering comes, I'm standing on it and I won't fall. I know that's a reality, but what happens as I'm still trying to get there? What happens when I'm there and suffering hits and it just doesn't comfort me to know that God's going to work good from this? Anyone else? What do we do in that place? What do we do in that moment? When we don't even want somebody to comfort us, we just want to sit in our grief. What do we do in that place? Hebrews 2, it's this really strange verse where it says that Jesus, he was made perfect through suffering. That he was made perfect through suffering. And it seems weird. I mean, Jesus was perfect, right? How did he have to be made perfect? Well, it means at least this. That he was made complete through suffering, that he had to become like us to save us. And so for Jesus to actually adequately really take our place, he had to suffer. And so Jesus suffered, and he became complete in that. He experienced that. He became like us in that he might then save us. And so then Hebrews 4, it says that we don't have a high priest then. We don't have this God who saves then, who's unable to sympathize with us. Why can he sympathize with us? Because he suffered with us. Because he suffered with us too. And so here's just this one thing that I want you to know. Just one thing I want you to be able to grasp and see. And it's not that God means evil out of good. We've got 12 more chapters where we can talk about that. Right? 12 more chapters where we can talk about our theology of God's providence and his sovereignty over all things and how he works good out of evil. Okay? 12 more chapters. Today I don't want to talk about that. Today I just want you to hear one thing. That you do not have a God who does not sympathize with you. Who does not sympathize with what you are suffering. That you have a God who knows. That he knows. He knows what it's like for somebody to conspire against you, to talk about you, to gossip about. He knows. He knows what it's like to be betrayed by those closest to him. He knows what it's like to cry out and nobody hears. He knows what it's like to have somebody determine your value. Somebody determine your worth. He knows. He knows. He knows the pain of humanity. Jesus wept, shortest verse in the Bible. He knows the loss of a loved one. He knows what it's like when your friends fail you in your greatest time of need. He knows the sorrows of this life, the tears of this life. He knows suffering. He knows. Jesus, he knows. I'm just so tired of hearing about all the suffering that's going on, if I'm just really honest. Today, more, just grieved about it. Some of you may don't know Paige. She's been a partner here for all 5 years, I think. And it's just suffering after suffering after suffering. She got a chronic illness, and all last year she was in the hospital pretty much every day. And last week she had to have heart surgery, completely unrelated to her chronic illness, just kind of another thing. And it's just like text after text and email after email and update after update. Sometimes it's good, but it's like that kind of good that's not, like it's good, it's encouraging good, but it's, we shouldn't have to have this kind of encouraging good. Oh, the medicine's working. That's good.